Welcome to Intersection Live, the tax and accounting profession's premier podcast source, provided by the CPA Technology Advisor and ADP Small Business Services, supporting the accountant community. This is Tech to Go, a monthly fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Darren Root and regular columnists of the CPA Technology Advisor. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession.
Hi, this is Darren Root, and you are listening to episode 33 of Tech to Go. First, I'd like to thank our corporate sponsor today, ADP, for today's podcast. Randy Johnston and I are going to be the only two online today. So, Randy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We have some great topics. Dave McClure and Renee couldn't join us. Renee Lesser couldn't join us today. So, Randy and I are going to bring three great topics to you. We're going to talk just a little bit more about Windows 7. I know Randy's running Windows 7. We're going to talk a little bit about this acquisition that Intuit recently made of Mint.com and what that means, and also a little bit about CCH and all the products that are rolling out this month. Does that seem fair enough, Randy?
I think we can do a good job, and those are all pretty critical topics for our practitioners on almost every front, I think. So do you want to start down the Windows 7 path first?
Yeah, let's do. We know they're launching, what, October 22nd? Is that the right date?
Yes, October 22nd is the launch date, and there's actually the OEM copies have been shipped to all of the hardware manufacturers for some time, and personally, I've actually had my organization on Windows 7 for about 60 days, and the reason that happened is Microsoft, for open license agreements, have made Windows 7 downloadable for, you know, some time. And so as soon as it was available, I'd been running beta long enough. A number of my team had been running the beta of Windows 7, and we actually made a strategic decision to convert our entire organization to Windows 7 during the second week of August. So at this point, we've got about 60 days on the product, the real live released product. The Windows 7 environment has actually caused me to do two things that I have not done in a long time, Darren. The two things were recommending a product both very, very early in its life cycle, and number two, to actually come home and talk to my wife about technology.
Those are both probably pretty big things.
Those are really big things because, you know, my wife is not a technologist, not really all that interested in it. But the thing that I'd like for the listeners to really hear about is with Windows 7, particularly using the Windows deployment feature that's available, we were able to install a complete Windows 7 desktop with all of the applications pre-installed, and the average time to get the installation done is about 20 minutes. A technician can handle three or four machines in an hour. So it's like 15 to 20 minutes. And, you know, in my case, I have multiple different types of machines that I'm using, but we were able to set up a master image and put those on with amazingly little intervention.
Wow, that's fantastic. So I know if I'm a listener out there right now and even sitting here listening to you trying to decide what I'm going to do at my firm, I'm thinking, okay, I've got a whole bunch of XP boxes in my office, and I'm running Vista on my machine. Do I think about upgrading some of these machines, or do I buy new boxes? What's your thought?
Well, I would probably buy new boxes would be the short answer. And the difference, though, is the first part of my comment. If it's post-tax season, it's second tax season, it's after October 15th, if I was buying a new machine now, I would wait for the October 22nd window, and I would actually take Windows 7. I would recommend our listeners very, very, very strongly not to deploy any more Windows Vista. Windows 7 is so much better than Vista. It is faster, it's more stable, it takes less memory. I could go down through all the technical attributes. But the real deal to me is if you're on one of the three upper versions, the professional, the enterprise, which is what I'm running, or ultimate, you get the XP virtualization, the Windows XP mode, if you will, in Windows 7. And I have had Windows XP applications that I personally could never get to run to my satisfaction on Windows Vista. They were just not compatible. And every Windows XP application that I've thrown at Windows 7 in XP mode has loaded perfectly and run perfectly. And so this issue about, wow, do we stay on XP? Well, if you're running old machines, ride Windows XP out, but you get some new machines, put Windows 7 on it. And I think even some of your older machines may deserve having Windows 7 installed.
Okay, so if you don't mind, give me, so if I'm going to order a box October 22nd, what requirements do I want to be looking at for that box?
Well, I'm going to be a little conservative here in that I'm trying not to spend so much money. This is more just a concern for our listeners who, you know, maybe things are a little tight. I would recommend a minimum of 2 gig of RAM, but realistically 4 is probably better. If money was not an object, I would absolutely have you put even more RAM on it, something to the tune of 8 gig of RAM. That would force you, though, to run the 64-bit version of Windows 7. Now, I've run both the 32-bit and the 64-bit with great success. I run production, and all of our deployment is in 64-bit, simply because we believe that's the way it's going. But, you know, a nice little machine with 2 gig of RAM with Windows 7 will actually perform acceptably well, and I think we'll be in the ballpark of the type of performance that you were getting with Windows XP, maybe a little better, maybe a little worse, but certainly acceptable.
The 64-bit, do I see any problems with any programs that an accounting firm is running as it relates to something that may that could possibly not be ready for 64-bit? Is that a concern?
It's a bit of a concern, and actually the official position of the major publishers, CCH and Thomson and Intuit, is we're not really quite ready to support 64-bit. They're really going to try to put off the official support, I think, in most cases until sometime after the 2010 tax season is complete. But, you know, that said, we have not encountered any application that we can't make run on the 64-bit platform. So I would be concerned for the listeners who maybe don't have a technical support people on staff, maybe who are a little less technical, maybe they would have issues getting the applications to run. And if they did and they called CCH or Thomson or Intuit tech support and said, you know, I'm running on 64-bit, you know, Windows 7, they may get pushback saying, well, we don't officially support that yet. Well, I don't think it should be a problem. And the safety net, in my opinion, is the Windows XP mode. Because if anything doesn't run on Windows 7, I just turn right around, install it Windows XP mode, and my rule of thumb right now is if it runs in XP, it's going to run in XP mode.
Good. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about this Intuit acquisition of Mint.com. Intuit seems to be on a bit of a buying spree at the moment. And Randy Davis just joined us, so I'm going to go ahead and make Dave live.
Good.
See if I can do that here.
That would be
Dave,
lovely.
Are you there? Dave, are you there?
I am, certainly. Sorry to be late.
No worries. Randy and I are already online, so we're glad you're here. So we're already talking about this. We just got done talking about Windows Vista or Windows 7 a little bit, and I know you wanted to add just a little bit onto that. We talked just about the October 22nd date coming up and the whole idea of what kind of a box we might order and that sort of thing. What thoughts did you have on that before we move on?
I've got the Windows 7 Ultimate, and I'm running it on basically a home-built 2 gigs of RAM with a 2 gig processor, quad processor, and I run twin 360 gig hard drives. So I guess my first impression of System 7 is really rock stable, and the upgrade process was very easy. Mostly what I wanted to look at is there are a host of interesting new features that are not even being talked about. I mean, everyone's talking about, well, is it stable, is it pretty, and all of that, but they're trying to put in some new systems to manage user IDs online. And I've just begun to delve into this thing and don't have it working really well, but I'd be interested, Randy, in your opinion of their efforts to do that.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you are correct. There's a number of features that are in the final code. And, you know, if we think about Microsoft's desire to be the keeper of the keys for user identity management, you know, it goes all the way back to the you know, the passports, the .NET passports, almost 10 years ago at this point. This actually looks pretty elegant, and I think they're keeping everything open enough. If I understand the standards, they've actually done a pretty good job of complying with OpenID, although it's not an OpenID. It's a Microsoftized piece. But I think that part of the system is actually pretty nice.
The only thing I have against it at this point is that because the operating system hasn't officially debuted, not many websites at all are using it. As I understand, the website essentially has to send a request to you.
Yes.
And then it will unlock it for that site only and send back your user ID, so you no longer have to log on. This will be done in a split second. But I'm very excited by it because I'm one of those people who can't remember 600,000 passwords.
Yeah, understood. And is your experience on 2 gig of RAM pretty solid? You know, you just heard that I said, look, if we're going to cut corners, 2 gig of RAM on Windows 7 may be okay.
I'm running just fine in 2 gigs of RAM. Not a hitch, not a problem, not a lockup, nothing. Now, having said that, I plan to update my equipment and go ahead and buff up because, as usual, I'm finding there are some quirky little things that don't work on the hardware side, and our old friend Hewlett-Packard is mostly to blame.
Yeah, and so, you know, even as we stand here, I don't have a lot going on today. I've got, you know, a Word document I was working on and some Outlook and messaging and web browsing, a pretty light load, and I'm actually running about 1.5, 2.5 gig, it looks like.
Right.
So, you know, 2 could be thin, and that, but we also would suggest that if you go beyond 4, you're going to have to be 64-bit, and I've run this thing with 8 gig of RAM, and it's just amazing how quick Windows 7 continues to operate at that level.
Yeah, again, my experience is that, you know, Microsoft is still sort of saying, hey, if you're a small office or a home user, you don't need 64-bit, and you're still going to find problems with drivers. That's what I'm finding anyway. The hardware support for the 64-bit version is not as solid as it is for the 32-bit version. And I guess my other thing to say about RAM is there are really two kinds of users out there. There's a person who comes in, opens up every program he's going to use that day, and leaves them open on their desktop. That person's going to need 4 gigs of RAM. If you are a person who comes in, goes into Outlook, exits Outlook, goes into Word, or maybe just leaves Outlook running in the background and does other things sequentially rather than multitasking them, 2 gigs is going to be fine for you.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely why I'm saying this is not a problem. And it also makes me really picture the Windows 7 running on a netbook as a real possibility.
I think that is a real possibility. And, in fact, my next step will be to get a netbook and try it out exactly that way.
Have you tried the netbook yet, Randy?
I actually have tried. I actually own multiple different netbooks, and I have not loaded Windows 7 on a netbook because most of the ones that I'm using, I'm either running the older Windows XP versions or I'm running Linux on the netbooks. So been kind of watching for what's going to happen with the new generation Windows 7 netbooks. have been actually watching for what's happening with the new Apple tablet, for example. And to me, the other real key feature that in Windows 7 that I think if we look back 2, 3, 4 years from now, we'll realize that the improvements in the touchscreen interface in Windows 7 is what actually made touchscreens usable for business purposes. I've been doing annotations in Adobe Acrobat. I've been doing, you know, working with documents. I'm finding what I'm doing is I'm grabbing my screen and resizing things instead of using a mouse. So this could make an awful lot of difference in review for our accountants out there.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about, we're going to pivot now, Dave, to this acquisition that Intuit recently made of Mint.com. And I was just saying when you called in that, you know, Intuit seems to be a bit on a buying spree lately. They acquired PayCycle for, I believe, about $170 million a few months ago. And they just spent another $170 million on Mint.com, according to an interview I watched with CNET and the CEO of Mint.com. So $340 million this summer, that's a pretty good outgo.
Well, it is. It is a large amount. But if you look overall at the software markets, this is the time when the giants are going to secure their positions. I think you've got Microsoft, you've got Google, you've got Intuit, and these are companies that are now sitting on a lot of cash, not really a good place to invest them. And the valuation of companies that they might yearn after, like Yahoo, for example, they're severely devalued now with the stock market down. So if you are a large company sitting on cash looking for somewhere to go, it's time to go buy some companies. So I think that's exactly what Intuit's doing. The other thing is Intuit has the strategy to move out of the QuickBooks TurboTax box, and you're seeing that, I think, being implemented as well very strongly.
So, Dave, I think your attitude on this acquisition piece is pretty important because, you know, right now Cisco's back out on the buying binge again with their, you know, acquisition of Tanberg this week. So, you know, when we start looking at, I'm sitting on cash, you know, who can I take out? There's some wonderful values in the marketplace for those companies with the cash.
I agree. And the other part of it, as you said, Randy, is who can I take out? And I think that's an important piece of the puzzle as well.
Yeah, so if you look at Cisco's, you know, HD video conferencing capability, their biggest competitor was probably Tanberg. So, you know, now they're in a position that they own more of the market share. In Intuit's case, we know that they're really, really focused on recurring revenue capabilities. And so they're much more interested in deals where they can have, you know, some slice of a pie. And my interpretation of the Mint acquisition is to maybe add some value to that, have something that they can get some recurring revenue from, and expand their market share. So I think it's a let's look what we can take out.
Well, and listening to this, the interview with the CEO, apparently what they're doing, I mean, the guy looked like a pretty young guy, and he started Mint, it looked to me, in about 2005, started getting some real funding in 06. So he's been around for about 3 years. Like I said, he just got $170 million, or at least that's what they paid for the company. And from what he said in this interview, he's going to be in charge of Quicken, desktop, and the SaaS product going forward. So the guy's taking on a pretty good-sized job because there's a big Quicken database out there.
Yep.
It's interesting to see the other thing because, as you probably know, I've been working very closely with the QuickBooks people, just getting a look at QuickBooks 2010 and looking, getting some glimpses of the directions they want to go. And fascinating stuff. It's very clear that they are trying to perhaps shift QuickBooks up into the mid-range. And that would leave an opening for then Quicken to expand to become more of a small business package. Because realistically, I think what they're finding is there aren't that many people who do their personal checkbooks online because you can't carry your computer with you to the store. And so what's the point of entering it in your checkbook once and then going back and entering it into Quicken? I think the largest installed base of Quicken users are actually small business people, because you can run a company very effectively off of Quicken, just, you know, Quicken and a bookkeeper, and you're good to go.
Guys, I think Renee might have just joined us. Is that you, Renee?
I did. I don't
oh,
know
good.
What was going on, but it was
yeah.
not letting me come in.
Sorry about that. We're in the middle of talking about the Mint.com acquisition, and I was just telling Randy and Dave, you know, it looked like they just paid $170 million, and they're going to let this guy from Mint.com sort of run Quicken. You have probably some insight into that since you talked to me about this a week or two ago.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, Brad has been telegraphing for a while that he was impressed and liked the things that were going on at Mint. And so you know, they went out and bought it. And, you know, the thing that all the buzz in the valley is about the fact that the back end, all the stuff that makes Mint great, comes from a company called Yodlee. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Yodlee, but you know, Yodlee is the back end of many of the bank's websites out there that do all the aggregation. So it's quite interesting that that's part of the buzz is that so what did they buy? And I don't know if you guys have talked about that yet, but you know, I think everything that I've heard is what they wanted, and the way Brad felt about Aaron is that Aaron was responsible for revitalizing personal finance and getting 1.5 million customers up on a personal finance system in the last 2 years that Intuit has not been able to get any traction in the online area.
Do you see a shift in that now? Well, he essentially indicated that Mint was going to become Quicken's online product.
Right.
And so do you essentially see this as obviously their big play to kind of start moving Quicken users to the web, kind of like they've done with QuickBooks to QuickBooks Online?
Yeah, I think, they have a Quicken Online, and maybe about a year and a half ago, they bought a small company that did some of the account aggregation that Yodlee does. So they had bought that, and I don't know about you guys, but I use Quicken. I played with Quicken Online. I played with Mint, and there's pros and cons. But, for any avid Quicken user, my feeling is that there is much functionality still missing in the online app. So, but I think this is a message from Brad and the folks at Intuit that they are going to, keep putting investment into the personal finance space and are going to try to make money at it. They haven't. The Quicken business is probably one of the smallest businesses at Intuit, even though that is the mainstay product that we all know it for. But, revenue-wise, it's the smallest one in the company.
Well, Randy, one of the things you and I were talking about earlier is, Microsoft seems to have given up in this space. What's your take on that?
Well, it sure feels like it, because obviously they made the discontinuation announcement for Microsoft Money, and I thought the announcement was interesting in that they said that with the broad interest in online capability, one part of it, number two, that with the automation that's available from many banking entities, they just didn't see that the online capabilities or money itself were worth continuing to build. So, they actually have a period which is now ended where you could extend the life of the product, but, officially it's going to die completely June 30th of 2010, I think is the right number.
And did you guys see the announcement that, Citibank and Microsoft are going to go compete against Mint and Intuit? Did you guys see that announcement?
Yeah, I saw that announcement, and it's like, okay, so, that kind of ties everything together to go with their announcements, and
right.
It's like, well, what does Citibank have an application we haven't seen yet?
Yeah, the question is this just rattling the sabers because they feel like they have to do something? But I'll tell you what's interesting about the bank play, and this is, I think, very critical for accountants. One of the things that that a former editor and I got into a horrible, horrible fight about, and he told me he almost screamed at me on a podcast once when I said accountants had better look to their payroll business before it's taken out from under them, and I would see if this trend continues a limited lifespan for accountants doing payroll, and the reason for that is the middleman, the banks, are beginning to chew through the marketplace. I sit in a small business office, and I must get two or three solicitations a week from banks saying, bring us your payroll business. We'll do it for free. We'll do direct deposits. We'll pay the taxes. We do all of that.
Yeah, I'm starting to see sort of the same thing, Dave. I think it's been out there for a while, and I'm sure, Renee, you have some thoughts on this since you were heavily in the payroll business for a good while. But what do you see there?
Well, yeah, I think there are definitely banks and some of the partners at PayCycle were out there marketing services at a discount or free. And you know, I think that, you know, I think the thing in general for accountants, and this is the thing I think, Darren, that you talk a lot about in your consulting practice is, you know, what is the real value add that an accountant should be adding? And, you know, there is value add that accountants can add on top of these services and, you know, having a holistic view. And I think, I guess I would encourage folks in the accounting space to be looking at, you know, if it's something that can be done automated fashion, you know, they ought to be one of the people that can offer to their clients. But then what's the value add? The value add, for example, with payroll might be the integration with the accounting software and the reporting and kind of helping them with an HR aspect and things that are a little bit more, you know, higher level strategic that I think that I as a small business owner, you know, would actually value more to have somebody who's kind of, you know, thinking about that holistically or, you know, tell me, yeah, have you thought about an HSA? And it, whatever the issues are, I think the stuff that can be programmed, I agree with Dave. You know, I don't know what the time frame is. It's going to go away from accounts. But everything I hear from accounts is they don't actually want to do that stuff. I mean, they have to do it. And, you know, the question is, can we find a way for accountants, you know, when I say we, I mean the industry, can we find a way for accountants to, you know, use these tools that you let them get to a different level of adding value? And I think the answer is yes.
Well, we need to pivot away from this because we have one more topic to address today. And this is, I guess in some ways it goes along with it, but CCH is rolling out a whole host of products that they've been working on for quite some time into a SaaS environment. So, Randy, you probably know most about this, so kind of tell us what's going on there.
Well, CCH has been in the development process for about 3 years, a little longer actually, but really proactively for 3 years, heavily funded by the parent company of Wolters Kluwer. Don't know what the final number would be, but initially they had announced that they'd spend about $100 million in the effort for development. They basically have a collection of products that they've acquired over time. They wanted to get some consistency in those, make them .NET compatible, to a degree web-enable the products. And so they have actually designed and rebuilt a good number of the products in their line. So later in the month of October, we'll see the initial announcements of their next-gen product, as they're currently calling them, where they have a new practice management product, which is the evolution of practice and practice management, best features taken and pulled together with some new features added. They have an updated version of their CCH document product. They actually have created a workflow product, which will be called Workstream. And, you know, as you start taking these through, including their tax product, which has actually had some fairly extensive work done and so forth, they're basically going to make the product suite available in their global data center out of Plano that's run by EDS. And one interesting little twist with Dell buying EDS over the last 10 days or so, you know, what's going to happen there. But we think at least for the next 6 months or something like that, CCH will continue to do the debugging of these products that are running in the global data center and then make the in-house or desktop versions of these available most likely May, June timeframe of 2010.
Sorry, Randy, but when you say the desktop versions of these, so they're going to have a desktop version of these new products as well?
That's right. They'll have in-house versions, and the plumbing on the back end is actually pretty interesting in that you can run the databases in a location, which if you're having communications problems or whatever, you can run everything local and traditional. But you can also ask the system to synchronize to the central data center, let's say in Plano, or perhaps your own centralized data center. So if you want to think distributed, replicated databases, by location or centralized, that's part of the plumbing that's in this product as well. So for our very large CPA firm listeners, you could think that they might have two major data centers where they run their own software, but in each location they actually have servers that replicate the data automatically, so you get local performance with centralized management. Or you can do everything centralized, or you can do everything distributed like you've always done it.
I have a question for you guys, and I know that some of you guys have actually seen it and were impressed, but the question that I have is, I guess it's kind of like you guys might have seen the Salesforce announcement with Unit 4, where they invested in an accounting software platform to be built on Salesforce.com platform. And I kind of wonder, what's the DNA? It's because Salesforce does have the software as a service DNA, and Coda does have accounting, but, I don't know, the marriage of the two seems like that's going to be a hard thing to succeed. And I kind of look at the DNA of CCH, and I hope I'm wrong, but I kind of say, are they really a software as a service company? Do they really understand, some of the things and what I haven't seen the app yet, so maybe you guys can dissuade me that that's something I shouldn't be concerned about.
Well, I think the key question you're asking there, Renee, is do they really have this centralized processing mentality? And if you go back historically, it's clear they do. But what has happened over time is they've evolved to more of the, Microsoft way of thinking about things. And, the concern and the reason I think they're doing the distributed database was just the concern about scalability to be able to handle the exceptionally high transaction volume. Think about the things that you had to do for PayCycle or Bill.com, and you're not going to do that on Microsoft SQL. Well, in effect, CCH took the strategy saying, we think we are going to be able to do it on Microsoft SQL. So I do believe that you're question about just the DNA is real important, because you're absolutely right. Like the Coda announcement, where that really was, let's build a product that's truly SaaS. They designed and built the product end-to-end in an unbelievable 8 months. And they actually have a fairly sophisticated product. And of course, they were doing a lot of co-marketing around the globe, actually, a lot here in the U.S. as well as U.K. and other places. And I have actually directly spoken with the new president of that company more than once. And the vision is clear. The attitude is spot on. And, so they're very, very serious and able to compete against the likes of Intact with some of what they're doing. And, when you think about Salesforce, who is a cooperative marketing partner with Intact, it's like Salesforce is playing every place that they can because of their SaaS models.
Right. Well, and I think I guess part of my underlying statement was, I still have questions about, whether Salesforce and Coda can do it, but at least they got accounting DNA and SaaS DNA, and, they're trying to marry them. So the question is, CCH clearly has the DNA about their products. I think that learning curve to make things SaaS is, unless they hired a bunch of people from, the SaaS arena, is harder than people realize. That's
Kind
of what he's built.
Yeah, one thing that's real clear to me in the new generation, next-gen products, is CCH was very focused on CPA firms at all levels, and they actually have features very specifically built in for small firms and very specifically features built in for very large firms, and the ability to quickly customize the product to filter the product to take away the large firm capability or to make it simple enough that a small firm can work on it without having to struggle their way through it. So it's a very interesting redesign, and it's not very often you get to see something built completely from scratch, which is what all the SaaS vendors have been doing over these last 10 or 11 years as that marketplace has been evolving.
I think the one real good thing that comes out of this is there's a lot of new innovation continuing to come out, and all that bodes well for us in the accounting profession. So that's a good thing, because this competition thing keeps going on and on.
Yeah, competition.
Yeah, no, great.
It is really good. In fact, I really like it where there's at least three competitors in any given segment. And to a degree, I think that might be part of what's, got Microsoft a little complacent about Windows because they didn't have good, strong competition. But as Linux came along and the Apple Mac operating system continued to push, I think it actually motivated Microsoft to improve Windows 7. And frankly, the pieces that we've seen in Office 2010, notable competitive improvements, particularly with the Office web apps piece that they're, they've had to build to compete against Google Docs.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, we're out of time today. I thank you guys for joining us. And any closing thoughts from anybody?
I'll just jump in to say I'm not convinced that it's necessary to wait till after Service Pack 1 to contemplate a move to Windows 7. I do think that since it's crazy to switch an operating system as you're headed into tax season, most people are going to wait until April or May before they look at the upgrade. But even by then, I would think it's fairly stable. And one comment on SaaS, remember that while they can build in features for smaller companies, there's also looming out there with some of their better features, the added-on layer of cost paying for the massive data centers. And, that's got to be reflected in the cost of the product. So, again, accountants in small firms are going to have to look very closely at their pennies as they make this transition.
Yeah, and Dave, on that one, you are dead on the do not wait for Service Pack 1. It is in such good shape as it stands. It is a mistake to stay on Vista, and it's a mistake to stay on Windows XP on any new equipment product purchase. That's the first time I've done this in 20 years. So I want our listeners to understand this is not just a casual Yadu and it's a heat-seeking technology thing. This is a really smart business decision if you're committed to stay on the Microsoft Windows platform. Don't do a dysfunctional thing of buying a new piece of hardware and taking it with Vista or trying to downgrade it to Windows XP. That would be a really bad error.
Well, I think that's a great closing thought for today, guys. Well, thank you guys very much, and look forward to talking to you next month.
Okay, thank you, Darren.
All right.
Take care, Randy.
Thanks.
Take care, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Good day.
Bye, guys.
The CPA Technology Advisors Intersection Live podcast series is brought to you by ADP Small Business Services, supporting the accountant community. For more information about the CPA Technology Advisors other podcast programs, webcasts, and our e-newsletter, visit cpatechnologyadvisor.com. To ask questions or leave comments about our podcasts, call 800-456-0864, extension 2106, or tune in to future episodes where you're able to ask questions live via talkshoe.com.